The National Sunday Law, The Argument of A.T. Jones Before the U.S. Senate Committee, December 1888, Part 4. Senator Blair, you are entirely logical because you say there should be no Sunday legislation by state or nation either. Mr. Jones, yes, sir, of course I'm logical, all the way through. I want to show you the wicked principle upon which this whole system is founded. And the reason I do this is because the last step is involved in the first one. If you allow this principle and this movement to take the first step, those who get the power will see in the end that they took the last step. That is the danger. See how in the 4th century the logic of it ended only with the Inquisition? Senator Blair, was the Inquisition abolished by the abolition of the Sunday laws? Mr. Jones, no, but the principle of it was established by Sunday laws. Senator Blair, then if the Inquisition was established by the Sunday laws, how was it abolished but by the abolition of the Sabbath? How can you remove an effect except by removing its cause? Mr. Jones, the Sunday laws never been abolished. Senator Blair, then the Sunday law could not have been the cause of the Inquisition. Mr. Jones, the power which embodies the Inquisition still continues, and its emissaries have been in this country defending the Inquisition. That same power is now grasping for the control of the civil law, and the same causes generally produce the same effects. Senator Blair, and the removal of the causes removes the effects with them. Mr. Jones, sometimes. Senator Blair, therefore, the Sunday laws were not the cause of the Inquisition unless the Inquisition still exists. Mr. Jones, no, the Sunday laws did not cause the Inquisition. Senator Blair, I understood you to say that it did. Mr. Jones, I say, through that the church received the power to make the principle and the work of the Inquisition effective. A certain exercise of power may be forbidden, and yet the means by which the power was obtained may not be forbidden. In other words, the power which was obtained through the deception of Sunday laws may be prohibited in certain things and yet allowed in many other things. Senator Blair, the Lord made the Sabbath and governed the Jewish nation for nearly 3,000 years with a Sabbath. Do you think the Sabbath was for the good of the Jewish people or for their injury? Mr. Jones, it was established for the good of the human race. Senator Blair, including the Jewish people? Mr. Jones, yes, sir. Senator Blair, it was established as a part of the civil administration. Mr. Jones, but the church and the state were one. Senator Blair, therefore, what we call the civil administration was included in that theocracy. Mr. Jones, the church and the state were one. They were united, and it was a theocracy. Senator Blair, if the administration of the Sabbath, during these 3,000 years at least, was for the good of the Jews and the human race, why will not the Sabbath be good for the Jews and the human race since the time of Christ as well as before? Mr. Jones, it is for the good of the human race. Senator Blair, the civil law must administrate it if it is done. Then we will get no Sabbath now under our division of powers of government unless we have the Sabbath recognized and enforced by the state authority. Mr. Jones, certainly we have a Sabbath. Senator Blair, your proposition is to strike out the Sabbath from the Constitution and condition of society in these modern times? Mr. Jones, no, sir. Senator Blair, certainly so far as its existence and enactment and enforcement by law concerned. Mr. Jones, yes, by civil law. Senator Blair, it was enforced in what we call the civil conduct of men under that theocratic form of government for at least 3,000 years. Mr. Jones, certainly. Senator Blair, Now, the observance of the Sabbath depends upon a compulsory observance of the law. Mr. Jones, not at all. Senator Blair, it required the law of God, which he enforced by death, by stoning men to death when they violated it. And we have the Sabbath day only by virtue of what we call the civil law, which is equally a part of God's law. Mr. Jones, that government was not organized specially to enforce the Sabbath. Senator Blair, they stoned men to death who violated the law. Mr. Jones, certainly, and likewise for the transgression of the other commandments. Senator Blair, God enforced it, in other words, by human means. Mr. Jones, certainly. My answer to all that is that that was a theocracy, a union of church and state. The church was the state, and the state was the church. Senator Blair, you say now that there is no state to enforce it? Mr. Jones, I say that no government can enforce the Sabbath or those things which pertain to God except a theocratic government, a union of church and state. Therefore, I say that if you establish such a law as here is proposed, you lead directly to a union of church and state. The logic of the question demands it, and that is where it will end, because the law cannot be enforced otherwise. These gentlemen say they do not want a union of church and state. What they mean by church and state is for the state to select one particular denomination and make it the favorite above all other denominations. That is a union of church and state according to their idea. But a union of church and state was formed by Constantine when he recognized Christianity as the religion of the Roman Empire. Everybody knows that that was a union of church and state, and that it ended in the papacy. A union of church and state is where the ecclesiastical power controls the civil power and uses the civil power in its own interests. That is where this movement will end, and that is one of the reasons why we oppose it. Senator Blair, you say the church and state separated shall not do those proper things which the church and state always did when united in the theocracy. Mr. Jones, no, sir. Senator Blair, then why do you say that the state? Mr. Jones, I did not mean to deny your proposition. I think the way you intended, I mean, yes, because I certainly do say that the church and state separated shall do those proper things which were done when they were united in the theocracy. Senator Blair, if in this division of the powers of government into church and state, you exclude from the powers of the church the establishment and enforcement and regulation of the Sabbath, why do you not necessarily, if the Sabbath is a good thing, pass it over to the control of the state? Mr. Jones, because if the church will not recognize it and preserve it, the state cannot compel people to do it. The state that attempts it is bound to fail. Senator Blair, then you necessarily take the ground that God did wrong in the enforcement of the Sabbath during those 3,000 years when his government was both church and state. Mr. Jones, no, sir. If God would come himself to govern and made himself governor, as he did of Israel, he could enforce the law as he did there. But until God does that, we deny the right of all the churches or anybody else to do it. Senator Blair, even if it's for the good of society? Mr. Jones, what they say is for the good of society is for the ruin of society. Senator Blair, do you understand that it is the church or the state that is making this law? Mr. Jones, it is the state that is doing it, just as Constantine did, to satisfy the churches. Senator Blair, it may or may not satisfy the churches. The churches give their reasons here, which may be right or wrong, for the establishment of the Sabbath, for this Sunday legislation in all the states. The state, the whole people, make the law. You say that the whole people shall not make a good law because the churches ask for it. Mr. Jones, I say the whole people shall not make a bad law, even though the churches do demand it. For any civil law relating to God is a bad law. Senator Blair, then what God did for 3,000 years for the good of the Jews and the human race was wrong? Mr. Jones, no, sir, it was right. Senator Blair, then why not continue it? Mr. Jones, because he has discontinued that kind of government. Senator Blair, we have done nothing in the world to divide the powers of government into those of church and state. We say those departments shall not interfere with each other. Mr. Jones, certainly. Senator Blair, here and in the states, we are trying to run the civil parts. We have taken jurisdiction of a portion of what God has entire jurisdiction as to the church and state in the civil relations of men. The entire society does that. We put the sovereignty into the hands of everybody except woman, and some of us are trying to do that. We have the same subject matter, the good of society under our control, which under the theocracy was united into both church and state. If you do not let the state continue to do what was essential to society then and is now, you are striking at one of the great ends for which government exists. Mr. Jones, not at all, because God has discontinued that kind of government. Senator Blair, he has not discontinued the necessity of laws for the regulation of society. Mr. Jones, he has in that way. Senator Blair, no, it is just as necessary that there should be a Sabbath now for the good of man as when God made and enforced the law by his direct supervision under a theocracy. Mr. Jones, but no government but a theocracy can enforce such laws. Senator Blair, then unless we have a theocracy, we shall have no Sabbath. Mr. Jones, we shall have no laws regulating the Sabbath. Senator Blair, the Sabbath did not descend to the Jews and to all mankind because there was a theocratic form of government among the Jews. How did the Sabbath come to mankind at large when there was no theocratic form of government? Mr. Jones, those nations never kept it. Nobody but the Jews ever kept it. Senator Blair, they could have kept it because you say the Sabbath existed for all, not for the Jews only, but for the human race. Mr. Jones, certainly, but if they did not keep it, it would do no good. Senator Blair, it did not exist for good then? Mr. Jones, certainly, a thing may exist for my good, and I may refuse to use it as thousands do the salvation of Christ. Senator Blair, I was taking your statement as true that it did exist for good outside of the Jews. Mr. Jones, I said it was for the good of man. The Savior said it was for the good of man. The Savior died for the good of man. Senator Blair, you would abolish the Sabbath anyway? Mr. Jones, yes, in the civil law. Senator Blair, you would abolish any Sabbath from human practice which shall be in the form of law unless the individual here and there sees fit to observe it? Mr. Jones, certainly. That is a matter between man and his God. Senator Blair, your time has expired. Please take 5 minutes to close, as I have asked you some questions. Still, there were questions that touched the trouble in my whole mind. Mr. Jones, certainly, but I supposed that I was to have an hour to devote uninterruptedly to the points in questions. Senator Blair, we have always been accustomed to conducting these hearings with reference to getting at the difficulties we had in our own minds, and I do not feel as though you could complain with an hour and 10 minutes if we gave you 10 minutes more. Mr. Jones, very good, Mr. Chairman. I have shown that in the 4th century, this same movement developed a theocracy, and in that, the papacy, religious despotism, and oppression for conscience' sake. Now I want to show the secret of at least a portion of the present movement. The representative of the National Reform Association spoke here in behalf of this proposed legislation. That association is asking for such a law and for such an amendment to the Constitution as you have proposed in relation to the Christian religion in the public schools. That measure pleases them well, and this proposed Sunday law pleases them well. Senator Blair, just incorporate that proposed amendment to the Constitution in your remarks. Mr. Jones, very well, it is as follows. Quote, 50th Congress, SR 86, First Session, Joint Resolution, proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States respecting the establishments of religion and free public schools, resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, two-thirds of each House concurring therein, that the following amendment to the Constitution of the United States be, and hereby is, proposed to the states to become valid when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states as provided in the Constitution. Article, Section 1. No state shall ever make or maintain any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Section 2. Each state in this union shall establish and maintain a system of free public schools adequate for the education of all the children living therein, between the ages of 6 and 16 years, inclusive in the common branches of knowledge and in virtue, morality, and the principles of the Christian religion. But no money raised by taxation imposed by law, or any money or other property or credit belonging to any municipal organization or to any state or to the United States shall ever be appropriated, applied, or given to the use or purposes of any school, institution, corporation, or person whereby instruction or training shall be given in the doctrines, tenets, belief, ceremonials, or observances peculiar to any sect, denomination, organization, or society being or claiming to be religious in its character, nor shall such peculiar doctrines, tenets, beliefs, ceremonials, or observances be taught or inculcated in the free public schools. Section 3. To the end that each state, the United States, and all the people thereof may have and preserve government, republican in form and in substance, the United States shall guarantee to every state and to the people of every state and of the United States the support and maintenance of such a system of free public schools as is herein provided. Section 4. That Congress shall enforce this article by legislation when necessary. Close quote. What then do these men propose to do with the civil power when they can use it? The Christian Statesman is the organ of that association, and in its issue of October 2, 1884, said, quote, give all men to understand that this is a Christian nation, and that believing that without Christianity we perish, we must maintain by all means our Christian character. Inscribe this character on our Constitution. Enforce upon all who come among us the laws of Christian morality. Close quote. To enforce upon men the laws of Christian morality is nothing else than an attempt to compel them to be Christians, and does in fact compel them to be hypocrites. It will be seen at once that this will be but to invade the rights of conscience, and this, one of the vice presidents of the association declares, civil power has the right to do. Reverend David Craig, now pastor of Park Street Church, Boston, a vice president of the National Reform Association, plainly declared in the Christian Statesman of June 5, 1884, that the civil power has the right to command the consciences of men. Reverend M.A. Galt, a district secretary and a leading worker of the association, says, quote, our remedy for all these malefic influences is to have the government simply set up the moral law and recognize God's authority behind it and lay its hand on any religion that does not conform to it. Close quote. When they have the government lay its hands on dissenters, what will they have it to do? Reverend E.B. Graham, also vice president of the association, in an address delivered at York, Nebraska, and reported in the Christian Statesman of May 21, 1885, said, quote, We might add, in all justice, if the opponents of the Bible do not like our government and its Christian features, then let them go to some wild, desolate land, and in the name of the devil, and for the sake of the devil, subdue it and set up a government of their own on infidel and atheistic ideas, and then if they can stand it, stay there till they die. Close quote. That is what they propose to do. And that is worse than Russia. In the Century for April 1888, Mr. Kennan gave a view of the statues of Russia on the subject of crimes against the faith, quoting statue after statue, providing that whoever shall censor the Christian faith, or the Orthodox Church, or the Scriptures, or the Holy Sacraments, or the saints, or their images, or the Virgin Mary, or the angels, or Christ, or God, shall be deprived of all civil rights and exiled for life to the most remote parts of Siberia. This is the system in Russia, and it is in the direct line of the wishes of the National Reform Association. Nor is that all. Reverend Jonathan Edwards, another vice president of that association, makes all dissenters atheists. He names atheists, deists, Jews, and Seventh-day Baptists, then classes them all together as atheists. I will read his own words, quote, "These all are, for the occasion, and so far as our amendment is concerned, one class. They use the same arguments and the same tactics against us. They must be counted together, which we very much regret, but which we cannot help. The first named is the leader in the discontent and in the outcry, the atheist to whom nothing is higher or more sacred than man, and nothing survives the tomb. It is his class. Its labors are almost wholly in his interest. Its success would be almost wholly his triumph. The rest are adjuncts to him in this contest. They must be named from him. They must be treated as, for this question, one party." Close quote. They class us as atheists and are going to condemn all alike, and you are asked to give them the power. Remember, these are the views of the members of the National Reform Association whose secretary stood at this table this morning in defense of the Sunday law. These extracts show what his ideas are and how he would use them. Dr. Everett of Chicago, who also was here, declared last month in Chicago in my hearing on the subject of the Sunday law that, quote, "it is atheism or the Sabbath," close quote. Mr. Edwards continues, quote, "What are the rights of the atheists? I would tolerate him as I would tolerate a poor lunatic, for in my view, his mind is scarcely sound. So long as he does not rave, so long as he is not dangerous, I would tolerate him. I would tolerate him as I would a conspirator. The atheist is a dangerous man. Yes, to the extent I would tolerate the atheist, but no more. Why should I? The atheist does not tolerate me. He does not smile either in pity or in scorn upon my faith. He hates my faith, and he hates me for my faith. I can tolerate difference and discussion. I can tolerate heresy and false religion. I can debate the use of the Bible in our common schools, the taxation of church property, the propriety of chaplaincies, and the like. But there are some questions past debate. Tolerate atheism, sir? There is nothing out of hell that I would not tolerate as soon. The atheist may live, as I have said, but, God helping us, the taint of his destructive creed shall not defile any of the civil institutions of all this fair land. Let us repeat, atheism and Christianity are contradictory terms. They are incompatible systems. They cannot dwell together on the same continent. Close quote. Senator Blair, many atheists are for Sunday laws. Mr. Jones, let them be so if they choose. But what I am striking at is that these men have no right to say that I am an atheist simply because I do not believe in keeping Sunday. Senator Blair, you come here and seriously argue against these people because they and the atheists blackguard each other. What have we to do with that? They abuse each other. It is worse in the Christian than in the atheist because the Christian has some rules to guide his conduct, which the atheist has not. Here seems to be some strong intemperate language which one human being makes use of towards another. An atheist or a Christian alike may find fault with that. I do not know any way that we can interfere with it, but if you claim to argue against this bill because these people abuse atheists, I reply to that by saying that many atheists are for this bill, just as these people are. They unite in support of this bill. Therefore, mutual recriminations amount to nothing. Mr. Jones, but the mutual recrimination amounts to this, that although this is confined simply to words between them now, Senator Blair, I do not think you ought to argue to us by taking this precious time of yours and ours to show that these people use intemperate language towards each other, Mr. Jones. But I am doing it to show that they use the intemperate language now, but if they get the law, they will use more than the language against them. These men only want to make the state a party to their religious disputes. They want to get the nation by law to commit itself to the defense of religious observances so they can add its power to their side of the controversy and send to hell or some other place where the devil is those who even accidentally disagree with them. But the state has no business to allow itself to be made a party to any religious controversy. This has been the bane of every nation except this, and God forbid that this one should be dragged from its high estate and made the tool of the irregular passions of religious parties. The state will find its legitimate employment in seeing that these parties keep their hands off each other, and that the ebullitions of their religious zeal are kept within the bounds of civility. It is not safe to put civil power into the hands of such men as these, but that is just what this Sunday bill will do if it shall pass. Senator Blair, the atheist is for this proposed law. He is not intelligently going to support a law which enables these people to burn him at the stake. Mr. Jones, I know he's not intelligently going to do it. Senator Blair, he is liable to be as intelligent as they are. Mr. Hume was a very intelligent man, so was Voltaire, so was Franklin. If Franklin was an atheist, Franklin was a deist at all events. Mr. Jones, it is safe to say that not one in 10 of the people whose names are signed in behalf of this Sunday law know what is the intention of it and what those will do with it when they get it. Senator Blair, then it is a lack of intelligence on their part. Mr. Jones, I know people who signed that petition who would now be just as far from signing it as I would. Senator Blair, that is because you told them of these terrible consequences which they had not believed would follow. The masses of the people do not believe that the Christian people of this country have united in every state in this union for such a purpose. Mr. Jones, here is the principle. Here are 6 million Protestants and 7,200,000 Catholics, Senator Blair. Cardinal Gibbons has written a letter which is in evidence. He is for it, and a great many Catholics also are for it. But it does not follow that those Catholics are for it simply because Cardinal Gibbons wrote that letter. They were for it before Cardinal Gibbons wrote the letter. You must remember that the Catholics in this country are intelligent as well as we. Some of them are ignorant. Some of us are ignorant, Mr. Jones, but here is the point. These people are complaining of the Continental Sunday, Senator Blair. They do not complain of it because it is Catholic. They complain of it because it is not good for the people as our form of Sunday. Mr. Jones, certainly. And in this movement, the American Sunday, they say, comes from the Puritans. And these people know, Senator Blair. Do you argue against it because it comes from the Puritans or because it comes from the Catholics? It comes from both, you say. We say it is for the good of society and that God is for it because it is for the good of man, Mr. Jones. But let me state the point that I am making. I think everybody knows that it is perfectly consistent with the Catholic keeping of Sunday for the Catholic to go to church in the morning and to the pleasure resort, if he chooses, in the afternoon. These men stand here in convention and cry out against the Continental Sunday and against its introduction here. Everybody knows that the Continental Sunday is the Roman Catholic Sunday. Yet these men, while denouncing the Continental Sunday, join hands with the Roman Catholics to secure this Sunday law. They have counted here 6 million Protestants and 7,200,000 Catholics. Suppose this law were secured in answer to these petitions. Would they then have a Puritan Sabbath or a Continental Sunday? In other words, would the 6 million Protestants compel the 7,200,000 Catholics to keep Sunday in the Puritan or even the Protestant way, or will the 7,200,000 Catholics do as they please on Sunday and let the 6 million Protestants whistle for the breath of the Puritan, which Dr. Herrick Johnson invokes? More than this, if it should come to compulsion between these, would not the 7,200,000 Catholics be able to make it unpleasant for the 6 million Protestants? Senator Blair, I have been all through this that the working people go through. I have been hungry when a boy. The first thing I can remember about is being hungry. I know how the working people feel. I have tugged along through the week and been tired on Saturday night, and I have been where I would have been compelled to work the next Monday morning if there had been no law against it. I would not have had any chance to get that 24 hours of rest if the Sunday law had not given it to me. It was a civil law under which I got it. The masses of the working people in this country would never get that 24 hours rest if there had not been a law of the land that gave it to us. There is that practical fact, and we are fighting with that state of things. The tired and hungry men, women, and children all over this country want a chance to lie down and rest for 24 hours out of the whole 7 days. Mr. Jones, so I have been through this that the working people go through. I have carried the hood by the day. I have swung the hammer and shoved the plane by the day. I am a working man now just as much as I ever was, though not in precisely the same way. And I say to you, that I never was robbed of that 24 hours rest, nor are there so many compelled to lose it as these Sunday law advocates tried to make out. Dr. Crafts said last night over in that convention that he had had communication with people in every nation but two, and, quote, in the world around he could not find a man who had financially lost by refusing to work on Sunday, but many have gained by the conscientious sacrifice, close quote. Much testimony was born in the Chicago Convention last month to the same effect in this country. And in the convention now, in session, in this city, the Honorable Mr. Dingley, member of Congress from Maine, said last night that the American working men are indifferent to the efforts which are put forth in this direction. Senator Blair, he is wrong about it. Mr. Dingley didn't know what he was talking about when he said that. Mr. Jones, he said he had investigated the matter. Senator Blair, I have investigated it, and I say that Mr. Dingley was simply laboring under a misapprehension. Mr. Jones, Dr. Kraft said this morning that he talked 2 hours with the convention of laboring men at Indianapolis, answering their questions until at the end of 2 hours they endorsed this movement. If they are crying for it, if they are fairly tearing their hair out for it, how can it be possible that he had to talk 2 hours to persuade them that it was all right? Senator Blair, take his statement in full if you take it at all. He says they are crying for it. Mr. Jones, then why was it necessary to talk to them for 2 hours? Senator Blair, then you simply say he did not tell the truth? You discredit the witness? Mr. Jones, I do. Senator Blair, you say perhaps he did not tell the truth, that is all? I think he was right. Mr. Jones, but the two things do not hitch together properly. If they are calling for it so loudly, certainly it ought not to require 2 hours to convert them. The fact is that the laboring men are not calling for it. Great effort is being made to have it appear so. But the Knights of Labor never took any such step except at the solicitation of Dr. Crafts. This bill has scarcely been introduced last spring before Dr. Crafts made a trip to Chicago and other cities soliciting the endorsement of the Knights of Labor. Instead of their petitioning for this Sunday law, they have first been petitioned to petition for it. For the object of it had to be explained and objections answered before they could even be brought to support it. The object of the petition for this bill was explained by Dr. Crafts to the Central Labor Union of New York and its endorsement secured. The Central Labor Union embraces a number of labor organizations, and the Christian Union declares the Central Labor Union to be a radically socialistic organization. This in itself would not be particularly significant were it not for the fact that the arguments which Dr. Crafts presents to these organizations to gain their support are entirely socialistic. Nor are these confined to Dr. Crafts. Other leaders of the movement also advocate the same principles. Dr. Crafts went to the General Assembly of the Knights of Labor at Indianapolis last month to get the delegates there to endorse the petition for the passage of this Sunday bill. He has referred to this in his speech here this forenoon and has made a portion of his speech to them and to the locomotive engineers a part of his speech here. A report of his speech at Indianapolis was printed in the Journal of United Labor, the official journal of the Knights of Labor of America, Thursday, November 29, 1888. He said to them there, quote, "Having carefully read and reread your Declaration of Principles and your Constitution, and having watched with interest the brave yet conservative shots of your powderly intemperance and other great evils, I have found myself so closely in accord with you that I have almost decided to become a Knight of Labor myself. If I do not, it will be only because I believe I can advance your principles better as an outside ally." Close quote. The following question was asked by one of the knights, quote, "Would it not be the best way to stop Sunday trains to have the government own and control the railroads altogether, as the Knights advocate?" Close quote. Dr. Crafts answers, quote, "I believe in that. Perhaps the best way to begin the discussion of government control for 7 days per week is to discuss this bill for government control on one day. If the railroads refuse the little we now ask, the people will be the more ready to take control altogether." Close quote. The Knights of Labor advocate the doctrine that the government shall take control of all the railroads in the country and hire the idle men in the country at regular railroad wages and run the roads as it now runs the post office department without reference to the question whether anything is made or lost by the government. This is what gives rise to the above question. Dr. Crafts proposes to play into their hands by making the bid for their support that if they will help the Sunday law workers get government control of the railroads one day in the week, then the Sunday law workers will help the Knights to get government control every day in the week. Another question that was discussed both there and at the Convention of Locomotive Engineers at Richmond, Virginia, was the following, quote, "Will not one day's less work per week mean 1/7 less wages?" Close quote. The response to this was as follows, quote, "As much railroad work as is done in 7 days can be done in 6 days and done better because of the better condition of the men. And on this ground, the engineers would be sustained in demanding and, if necessary, compelling the railroad company to so readjust the pay schedule that the men will be paid as much as at present." Close quote. That is to say, Dr. Crafts and the Sunday law workers propose to stand in with the laboring men to compel employers to pay 7 days' wages for 6 days' work. This is made certain by the following petition to the state legislators, which is being circulated everywhere with the petition for this bill. I got this at the Chicago Convention. Dr. Crafts distributed the petitions by the quantity there, and he is doing the same at the convention now in this city. Quote, to the state senate or house, the undersigned earnestly petition your honorable body to pass a bill forbidding anyone to hire another or to be hired for more than 6 days in any week, except in domestic service and the care of the sick, in order that those whom law or custom permits to work on Sunday may be protected in their right to some other weekly rest day and in their right to a week's wages for 6 days' work, close quote. Now, a week consists of 7 days. A week's wages for 6 days' work is 7 days' wages for 6 days' work. This petition asks the legislators of all the states to pass a law protecting employees in their right to 7 days' wages for 6 days' work. No man in this world has any right to 7 days' wages for 6 days' work. If he has a right to 7 days' wages for 6 days' work, then he has an equal right to 6 days' wages for 5 days' work, and to 5 days' wages for 4 days' work, and to 4 days' wages for 3 days' work, to 3 days' wages for 2 days' work, to 2 days' wages for 1 day's work, and to 1 day's wages for no work at all. This is precisely what the proposition amounts to. For in proposing to pay 7 days' wages for 6 days' work, it does propose to pay 1 day's wages for no work. But if a man is entitled to 1 day's wages for doing nothing, why stop with 1 day? Why not go on and pay him full wages every day for doing nothing? It may be thought that I misinterpret the meaning of the petition that, as it asks that nobody be allowed to hire another for more than 6 days of any week, it may mean only that 6 days are to compose a week, and that it is a week's wages for 6 days only that is to be paid for 6 days' work. That is not the meaning of the petition. It is not the intention of those who are gaining the support of the Knights of Labor by inventing and circulating the petition. Dr. George Eliot, pastor of the Foundry Methodist Church in this city, the church in which this National Sunday Convention is being held, the church that is now festooned with 14 million petitions that they haven't got, festooned at least partly with 1,700,000 times multiplied Cardinal Dr. Eliot, while speaking in favor of this bill this forenoon, was asked by Senator Call these questions, quote, do you propose that Congress shall make provision to pay the people in the employ of the government who are exempted on Sunday for Sunday work? Mr. Eliot, I expect you to give them adequate compensation. Senator Call, do you propose that the same amount shall be paid for 6 days' work as for seven? Mr. Eliot, I do, for the reason that we believe these employees can do all the work that is to be done in 6 days, and if they do all the work, they ought to have all the pay, close quote. There it is in plain, unmistakable words, that they deliberately propose to have laws, state and national, which shall compel employers to pay 7 days' wages for 6 days' work. This is sheer socialism. It is the very essence of socialism. No wonder they gained the unanimous endorsement of the Convention of the Knights of Labor and of the Locomotive Engineers and the Socialistic Labor Union of New York City by proposing to pay them good wages for doing nothing. I confess that I, too, would support the bill under such a proposition as that if I looked no further than the money that is in it. But this is not all. The Knights of Labor not only accept the proposition, but they carry it farther and logically too. This principle has been advocated for some time B, the Knights of Labor in demanding 10 hours pay for 8 hours work, virtually 2 hours pay for doing nothing. The Christian Union and the Catholic Review proposed to help the working men secure their demanded 8-hour law and then have the working man help to get the 6-day law by forbidding all work on Sunday. Dr. Crafts and Dr. Elliott go a step further and propose to secure the support of the working men by having laws enacted compelling employers to pay them full wages on Sunday for doing nothing. But the Knights of Labor do not propose to stop with this. The same copy of the Journal of United Labor, which contained the speech of Dr. Crafts, contained the following in an editorial upon this point, quote, "Why should not such a law be enacted? All the work now performed each week could easily be accomplished in 5 days of 8 hours each if employment were given to the host of willing, idle men who are now walking the streets. It is a crime to force one portion of a community to kill themselves by overwork, while another portion of the same people are suffering from privation and hunger with no opportunity to labor." The speech of Reverend Mr. Crafts, published elsewhere, furnishes an abundance of argument as to why such a law should be put in force, close quote. So when the Sunday law advocates propose to pay a week's wages for 6 days' work of 8 hours each, because all the work can be done in 6 days that is now done in seven, then the Knights of Labor propose to have a week's wages for 5 days' work, because by employing all the idle men, all the work that is now done in 7 days can be done in five. And as Dr. Elliott has said, quote, "If they do all the work, they ought to have all the pay," close quote. But if a week's wages are to be paid for 5 days' work of 8 hours each, that is to say, if 2 days' wages can rightly be paid for no work at all, why should the things be stopped there? If the government is to take control of the railroads all the time in order to pay 2 days' wages for doing nothing, and if the states are to enact laws compelling employers to pay employees 2 days' wages for doing nothing, then why shall not the government, both state and national, take possession of everything and pay the laboring man full wages all the time for doing nothing? For if men have the right to 1 day's wages for no work, where is the limit to the exercise of that right? The fact of the matter is that there is no limit. If a man is entitled to wages for doing nothing part of the time, he is entitled to wages for doing nothing all the time. And the principle upon which Dr. Crafts and his other Sunday law confreres gained the support of the working men to this Sunday bill is nothing at all but the principle of downright socialism. There is a point right here that is worthy of the serious consideration of the working men. These Sunday law workers profess great sympathy for the laboring men in their struggle with the grinding monopolies, and by Sunday laws they propose to deliver the working men from the power of these monopolies. But in the place of all these other monopolies, they propose to establish a monopoly of religion and to have the government secure them in the perpetual enjoyment of it. They may talk as much as they please about the grasping, grinding greed of the many kinds of monopolies, and there is truth in it, but of all monopolies, the most greedy, the most grinding, the most oppressive, the most conscientiousless the world ever saw or ever can see is a religious monopoly. When these managers of religious legislation have delivered the working men from the other monopolies, granting that they can do it, then the important question is, who will deliver the working men from the religious monopoly? This is the end of part 4.